All right, let's imagine that you walk into your church service on Sunday morning, and you sit down in the pew, you open the bulletin, and I don't know, the order of service is not in your bulletins, right? But let's say it is. And so you're perusing it before the service, and you look at the order of service, and it looks something like this. And you look, okay, we're going to sing a hymn. Yeah, that's commanded in the New Testament. And we're going to have a scripture reading, that's commanded in the New Testament. And then we're going to have an offering, that's commanded in the New Testament. And then we're going to have a sermon, that's commanded in the New Testament. And oh, look, today we're going to have a square dance on the platform. Yay! Now, this is an extreme example. I'm being a little bit silly to make a point. But what John Frame would have to say, and what even those who strictly hold to the normative principle would have to say, is that as long as square dancing is not prohibited in the Bible, and they might say, well, it is for this reason or that. So I'm not saying that belief in the normative principle or in John Frame's redefinition means that you're going to have square dancing, because they might still say that you can't have it for some particular reason. But what they would have to say is, well, congregational worship is no different than all of life if we can square dance in all of life, and they might, we can square dance, then we can do it in worship. And what the regulative principle was intended to be would say that if you have a worship service like this, and you have the pastors are saying you need to participate in this. If you're in our church service, you're kind of expected to participate in this. You're expected to participate in this, and you're expected to participate in this. What the regulative principle says, deriving from those four points we talked about, the fourth being Christian liberty from Romans 14, is that church authority, church leadership does not have the authority to expect the people to do something that is not commanded or sanctioned in the Bible. Let me read to you, this is T. David Gordon. He wrote a journal article in response to Frame, and this is what he says. Frame's attempt to put all of life under one umbrella is doomed to futility because it does not address the very issue the regulative principle was designed to address. Well, what was that issue the regulative principle was designed to address? It is this: the limits of church power and the liberty of conscience. If there is no distinction between what is lawful for an individual and what is lawful for the church to require of everyone, then Paul's discussions in 1 Corinthians 7 through 9 and Romans 14 make no sense. Such texts presuppose and in fact positively teach that there are things that an individual may freely do. You know, maybe it's okay to square dance in a barn. So there are things that an individual may freely do which may not be required of others. So do you understand the difference now between all of life and congregational worship? When we enter into a context of congregational worship, by definition, we are requiring people to do certain things. And the regulative principle in its purest form says you cannot require people to do things in congregational worship that have not been, depending on your view, commanded, sanctioned in the New Old Testament. Okay? Now, one more point in how we are going to approach the Bible. And that is, what are going to be our dispensational considerations? Okay, as dispensationalists, how are we particularly going to view the Old Testament? And this is where I will differ a little bit from Mike Barrett and Lig Duncan, and even Peter Masters. Okay, I promoted these three books because in application, they end up in the same place as maybe I would. Not in every area, but in a lot of areas. but in how they argue it. For instance, Mike Barrett says he holds to what he calls a pure continuity. During the next break, can somebody maybe find some nicer markers? I'm fine for now, but if somebody could do that, that'd be great. He holds to a pure continuity between the Old and New Testament, meaning, and Mr. Riley dealt with this in his philosophy class yesterday, Israel equals what? The church. So, if it's commanded for Israel, if Israel did it, if it's sanctioned by for Israel, then it's just as much as doing it to commanding it for the church. So all covenant theologians would be either here or here. They would not limit themselves to the New Testament at all. Because if it's commanded for Israel, then it's commanded for the church. I mean, they're the same thing, right? According to a covenant theologian. As a dispensationalist, and we're going to talk about this, we see some continuity. Because both Israel and the church are the people of God. God is the same. We're going to see worship in some senses is very much the same, but in other senses it's very much different. And so while there is some continuity, there is also discon. I am notorious for having outrageous spellings on a whiteboard because I'm talking, thinking, and writing all at the same time, and I get made fun of a lot, so feel free to laugh. So as dispensationalists, we see discontinuity between Israel and the church. They are not the same thing. Sir?
Are you saying that...
No.
What are you trying to say?
This is what covenant theologians like Mike Barrett, Lig Duncan, and Peter Masters would say. They believe in pure continuity. There's almost no discontinuity for them. They will see some discontinuity, obviously. But for them, there's pure continuity. Israel is the church, so anything commanded for Israel is commanded for the church. Now, to be fair, they're going to say with the coming of Christ, the ceremonial aspects of the law are done away with. They're going to reinterpret some things based on the New Testament, which they should. But they're going to see a pure continuity. So in some places in the textbook, Barrett says, because I see a continuity, I come to this conclusion. And I come to the same conclusion as he does, but not because Israel equals the church, for reasons we're gonna see in a moment. Okay? So the first important point is, for a dispensationalist, a distinction between Israel and the church must be maintained. Okay, and we're going to look at, in the last hour today, predominantly, John chapter 4, when Jesus makes very clear a delocalization of worship. And covenant theologians don't deny this, okay? But we're going to look at, the New Testament makes it very clear that things are different. And the covenant theologian wouldn't deny that, but they will also see a continuity. So how then, as dispensationalists, can we or should we view the Old Testament, particularly in this issue of worship? Okay? A statement and then a couple passages and then how we're going to apply it. Okay, the statement is this. Old Testament ritual was established by God to demonstrate universal moral principles in a lot of instances, and we'll determine how we can find that. Okay? Let me restate it. A lot of Old Testament ritual demonstrates universal moral principles, or universal principles of worship. So when we look at the Old Testament, we don't see a pure continuity. Israel is not the church. Just because something was commanded or expected of Israel does not necessarily mean that it is commanded or expected of the church. But, in general, the Old Testament rituals of worship do teach us universal moral principles of worship. Okay, a couple passages. Hebrews 8:5. The author is talking about the Old Testament sacrifices, the temple, all that stuff. And he says this, "Who serve unto the example and shadow of heavenly things, as Moses was admonished of God when he was about to make the tabernacle. For, see, saith he, that thou make all things according to the pattern showed thee on the mount." In other words, God gave Moses a particular pattern in constructing the tabernacle because it reflected something about heavenly worship. It reflected something universal in terms of worship. And our struggle is going to be how to determine that, and we're going to come to that. Another passage, 1 Corinthians 10:11. "All these things," that is all those things that happened in the Old Testament, "happened unto them for ensamples," examples, "and they are written for our admonition upon whom the ends of the world are come." It's 1 Corinthians 10:11. In other words, all that stuff in the Old Testament, though there is a discontinuity, though Israel doesn't equal the church, is still there for our benefit. It serves as examples for us, and it illustrates universal principles that God wants us to know about Him, about what He expects in worship, etc. So the question then is, how do we determine universal principles? Okay, and for this, I'm going to cite Roland McCune, who taught both Mike and I at Detroit, who is a good dispensationalist, and he lists four principles for determining universal principles in the Scripture. Here are the four principles. Okay, number one. The Bible clearly restates such a principle. So if something happens in the Old Testament and we wonder, I wonder if this is teaching us a universal principle about worship, then we're gonna look at other places in the Bible where it's restated as such, and particularly the New Testament for the church. Okay, so the first way that we can determine a universal moral principle is if it is restated as such. Number two, it is based on the nature of God. So we may look at a particular ritual in the Old Testament and discern a universal principle about that because it reflects the very character and nature of God. So then we'll say, well, we don't have to do this actual act, this actual ritual, but this principle we can draw out of it for our worship because it reflects God, who is universal, who doesn't change. Okay, number three, it is based on the natural created order of God. So there obviously is continuity in terms of God and who He is. There is continuity in terms of who we are and in terms of the natural created order. So if we find a principle based on the character and nature of God and based on the natural created order, we can discern it to be a universal principle. Number four, it does not conflict with the gospel or otherwise cause a biblical, theological, or dispensational conflict. Let me repeat that. It does not conflict with the gospel or otherwise cause a biblical, theological, or dispensational conflict. In other words, the principles that we're going to pull out of the Old Testament rituals, if they meet the first three qualifications, we can say that they are universal as long as they don't contradict with some clear revelation for the church in the New Testament. Okay? So how are we going to determine the universal principles? Ma'am? The natural created order. For instance, some will say that viewing man as head over the woman was a cultural thing in the Old Testament. It's a cultural thing in the New Testament. Paul had a bone to pick, and we would say, no. It's based on the natural created order. Man, and the New Testament is clear about this, right? 1 Corinthians 11, man was created first, woman was created second. It is based on the natural created order that man is the head of the woman. Okay? So that's one, that doesn't apply to worship particularly, but that is one universal principle that is based on the created order, and the New Testament is very clear about that one. Homosexuality being another one. I mean, the Bible does say homosexuality is sin, but even if it didn't, you know, Romans chapter 1, it's against nature. It's against the natural created order. There's a universal principle there. Okay, so the four things are, the Bible clearly restates such a principle. So we're not going to look at one little verse and one little part of the Old Testament and say, ooh, I'm going to pull my whole theology out of that. Okay, we're going to look for things that are common themes, they're restated. Okay, number two, based on the nature of God. Number three, based on the natural created order of God. And number four, does not conflict with New Testament revelation for the church, dispensational considerations, etc. So there is profitability to the Old Testament and how they did worship. But it's profitable in that we're going to try to discern universal principles, universal themes that will be able to be applied to us. Make sense? All right, let's move into a discussion of worship in the Old Testament. Obviously, the topic of worship and the Old Testament are broad, too broad for us to discuss exhaustively. So what we're going to attempt to do is survey the major significant times in the Old Testament redemptive history, view what happened with worship there, and discern some universal principles. Number one, creation. Genesis 1 and 2. Some of these we'll deal with just briefly. I want to make some minor points. Some of them we'll actually open the text and do some work in. And I'm just kind of going to be watching the clock. We'll probably start the next hour with a little bit of this and then move into the New Testament. We'll see how things go. Creation, Genesis 1 and 2. In the creation narrative, what judgment does God pass on his creation at the end of each day? What does he say? It is good. Okay? What did he mean by that? You know, the English word good can have a semantic range of meaning. It can mean morally good. It can mean useful, you know, practically. Or, if I get home on Thursday night and my wife picks me up from the bus station, I say, boy, you look good. Now, what do I mean? She looks morally good? Maybe. She looks practically good? No, I mean, she looks good. You know, it's an aesthetic judgment, right? The Hebrew word here has similar semantic range. It could mean everything is morally pure. It could mean everything is useful. You know, this is a good pen because it writes. Or it could mean aesthetically pleasing. Now, what kinds of things is it that God passes this judgment upon? Fish, trees, sun. Are things moral? Can a tree do good or bad? No. Can a fish do good or bad? What is the only thing that God created that can do something good or evil? Man. So if God had only passed the judgment of good, tov is the word there, T-O-V, the Hebrew word. If God had only passed the judgment of good upon humans, we might well conclude that he was talking about moral purity, because at the moment of the creation, before the fall, man was morally pure. He was good in that sense. What I think God's primary judgment upon creation was in Genesis 1 and 2 was that it was beautiful. It was aesthetically good. And we see that throughout Scripture. We see that word, that concept, God passing aesthetic judgment upon his creation in similar ways. The only point I want to make here is that in the mind of God, and this is going to obviously apply to our discussions of worship, particularly music, in the mind of God at least, there are objective standards for what is good in terms of beauty. For God to say this is good presupposes that there are objective standards for beauty. Okay, now with a lot of these, I'm not going to draw any conclusions or applications really today. We're simply going to collect biblical data and then bring it into a synthesis. Yes, sir?
Would you restate what you just said?
In the mind of God, there are objective standards for beauty. Okay, I'm not at this point saying that we can even discern them necessarily. But at least in God's mind, he can say, this is beautiful, and that is ugly. Okay? Number two, man's purpose. And for this, I'd like you to turn to Genesis 2:15. Genesis 2:15. This verse gives us man's purpose from God's perspective. He has just created man, and Genesis 2:15 says, "And the Lord God took the man," literally rested the man, "and put him into the garden of Eden for two purposes, to dress it and to keep it." Now here's the question. This is prior to the fall. At this point, there's no thorns, there's no thistles, there's no sin, the creation hasn't been subjected to futility, hasn't been marred by the fall. So why would Adam need to dress it and keep it, or would he even? Would Adam had to do any gardening in the Garden of Eden? I wouldn't think so. Now, the words here translated dress and keep, and most translations translate them similar to that. They basically mean, the word dress could be translated serve. So he was put in the garden to serve, is one way of translating that. The word keep could be translated obey, to dress and keep. You know, you keep a commandment, you obey a commandment, right? Okay? You dress somebody, you are serving someone. So it's all within the semantic range of these words. What determines meaning for words?
Authorial.
What's that?
Authorial.
Authorial intent, and how can we determine authorial intent?
Context.
Context always determines meaning, right? So how do we know what these words mean, dress and keep? Does it mean dress in the sense of gardening and keeping in the sense of gardening? Or does it mean, like these words can mean in their semantic range, to serve? Or another meaning of this word that's very closely connected to serve is worship. The word keep can mean to obey. What I think really God was intending for man at the beginning of time was not to be a gardener. And you'll hear this said, man's purpose, God's purpose for man, was to be a gardener. But this was before the fall. It didn't need any gardening. I think what God was saying here is that man's purpose is to worship and obey. Genesis 2:15, put him in the Garden of Eden, and the words it there are just applied by the translators because it would be natural, to dress, serve, worship, and keep, obey. This is man's purpose. Man was created to worship and to obey that which is worshipped. And obviously, God. Okay, number three, Sabbath rest. Genesis 2, verses 1 through 3. Let's read these very briefly. Thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the host of them. And on the seventh day God ended his work which he made, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work which he had made. And God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, set it apart, because that in it he had rested from all his work which God created and made. Why did God rest on the seventh day? Was he tired? Boy, a lot of work. Created this whole world in 6 days.
To show man that it's good for him to rest, or was it for more of a principle for man that he's kind of showing us through his own actions to man that this is what you need to do?
Possibly. Possibly. Let me give you an example. Well, I was going to use an example about mowing the lawn. That won't work here. I'll use it anyway. In Illinois, I have a beautifully lush green lawn. It's wonderful. And after a long day of mowing the lawn, weed whacking, trimming, pruning my flowers and my plants, what am I probably going to do next? I'm going to go in the house. I'm going to get myself a big, cold glass of lemonade. I'm going to sit out on my deck, and I am going to enjoy what I just did. I'm going to rest. But not, I mean, for me, it's going to be because I'm tired, but it's not just that. I'm going to delight in my work. Right? And this goes for any kind of work. After it's done, part of resting from what you've done is to sit back and say, boy, I did a good job. I think that's what God was doing. He was delighting in his work and in himself for what he had done. That was God's purpose in that seventh day. And really, for God, that's never ended. You say, well, what about sin? What about the fall? Well, that was in his plan too. That's all part of it. It's all part of the beauty of his plan. So I think a definition of Sabbath rest is delighting in God and his work. That's what God did. We can't define Sabbath rest as resting because we're tired, because God didn't do that. Sabbath rest is delighting in God and his work. That's what God did. He delighted in himself and what he had done, and he had all the right in the world to do so. Sabbath rest is delighting in God and his work. Okay, next, Cain and Abel. We won't take time to read it because you know the account so well, but Genesis 4, 3 through 8. What conclusions about worship can we draw from Cain and Abel? Well, number one, nothing is said in the text about the content of the offering itself. You know, that's the natural conclusion. Well, God must have told them not to bring fruit, and he brought fruit to God and didn't accept them. Well, we don't have any revelation there. So we can't, I don't think we can really draw that conclusion necessarily. It may have been, but the text doesn't tell us that. Quality may be in mind, because the text says that Cain brought some fruit and Abel brought the fat of the firstborn. So maybe it has to do with the quality of what they brought. But it's not clear in the text. I don't think we can necessarily draw that. What is clear is that God didn't accept Cain's offering because of his attitude and motivation in making the offering. His attitude and motivation were deficient. All right? Again, we're just gathering data. We're going to draw some synthesis in a moment. Next, let's talk about the Ten Commandments. The beginning of the law. The first two commandments of the Ten Commandments deal with what? Worship, don't they? Right? What's the first commandment? First commandment tells us There is only one person who may be worshipped, and it is whom? God, Yahweh, the God of Israel. Okay, that's the first commandment. Now, did God stutter on the second commandment and really kind of say the same thing? You know, can't worship any graven images. Was his point in that saying, you know, again, you can only worship me? Or was it something different? First commandment was, the only person whom you may worship is God. The second commandment was, you may only worship me in the way that I tell you you can worship me. You can't form some kind of graven image and say, well, this is Yahweh, and I'm going to worship him in this way. Okay, so the first commandment, both the first two commandments talk about worship. The first is the proper one whom you may worship, and the second is the proper means through which you may worship. Okay, so the Ten Commandments begin with commandments regarding worship. That's Exodus 20:2 through 4 is one of the statements of the Ten Commandments. Okay, next, the Law of Moses itself. The Law of Moses. For this, I'd like you to turn to Deuteronomy chapter 12. Deuteronomy chapter 12. This is one of the accounts of the giving of the law. And this is, Deuteronomy chapter 12 is the chapter that gives us God's instructions in the law concerning worship. Okay, let's read verses 2 through 4. Well, we'll start with verse 1. These are the statutes and judgments which ye shall observe to do in the land, which the Lord God of thy fathers giveth thee to possess all the day that ye live upon the earth. Ye shall utterly destroy all the places. Now, word places has direct reference to the places of worship wherein the nations which ye shall possess served their gods. Okay, so that is made very explicit there. Upon the high mountains, and upon the hills, and under every green tree. So when you go into the land, I want you to destroy every pagan center of worship. Get rid of it all. Number 3, and ye shall overthrow their altars, and break their pillars, and burn their groves with fire, and ye shall hew down the graven images of their God, and destroy the names of them out of that place. Ye shall not do so unto the Lord thy God. Now someone might naturally have asked, well, why can't we just keep their altars? I mean, we worship with altars too. Why can't we use their altars? Or, you know, what's better about our temple than their temple? I mean, we're still going to worship you, Yahweh. But why can't we use their stuff to do it? But God was very clear in the giving of the law of Moses. The Lord forbids, here's the principle, the Lord forbids his people to imitate pagan ways of worship. He wants to be worshipped in a particular way, not using their places, not using their pillars or altars or groves or images. In fact, I want you to destroy even the terminology, the names, is what he said. Destroy even the names thereof. I don't want any of that in my worship. That's pagan worship. I don't want any of it. God rejects worship that imitates the world, that uses pagan forms. God says how he wants to be worshipped, and that's what verses 5 through 8 give us. But unto the place which the Lord your God shall choose out of all your tribes to put his name there, even unto the habitation shall you seek, and thither thou shalt come. And then he goes, so he says, I'm going to tell you where I want to be worshipped. I'm going to tell you how I want to be worshipped. So it's not enough just to worship the right person. You have to worship the right person in the right way, is the principle here. Okay? Okay, what about their worship in the wilderness? First of all, Exodus 32, verses 4 through 6. This is the incident of the golden calf. Okay, so we won't take time to read it because you all are familiar with it. Moses goes up to receive the law. Joshua goes up with him. In the meantime, the people say, hey, Aaron, build for us a calf. They give all their gold. He melts it, builds a calf, and they start to worship the calf. Okay, now a couple points here. Was it that they were worshiping another god? Was the problem with what they did that they were worshiping a false deity? No. They were attempting to worship whom?
Yahweh.
They say, this is the God who delivered us from Egypt. And they knew who that was. It was very clear to them. They were attempting to worship the God that they should be worshiping, but they were doing so in a way that he had not commanded. In the passage where it's a little bit confusing because it says, because Aaron says to the people, in all the translations it is translated this way, these are thy gods who delivered thee from Egypt. So you might think, well, they're worshiping false gods. But this is important. The word translated thy gods, G-O-D-S, is the word Elohim. That im ending is a plural ending. Elohim can be translated G-O-D-S in the plural. But that term, Elohim, even with the plural ending, is often used for the God of the Bible, and the plural ending is not meant to be taken as a plural. It's meant to be shown as a sign of respect, of power, of plurality in the sense of wonder and power and respect. So just because the word Elohim is used, and you all know, I mean, that's a common name for God, right? Elohim is commonly used for the God of the Bible, and it can, and it's also used to talk about false gods. So just because it uses Elohim and our translators translated it gods, we got it. Again, context determines meaning. And what's clear is they say, these are thy gods, this is thy God, this is thy Elohim, which delivered thee from Egypt. And they all knew who delivered them from Egypt. So it wasn't that they were worshiping the wrong God, is that they were worshiping in the wrong way. Okay? One more instance in the wilderness, Leviticus 10, 1 through 3. Leviticus 10, 1 through 3. You can turn there if you want, I'll read it to you. And Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, took either of them his censer, and put fire therein, and put incense thereon, and offered strange fire before the Lord, which he commanded them not. And there went out fire from the Lord, and devoured them, and they died before the Lord. Then Moses said unto Aaron, this is it that the Lord spake, saying, I will be sanctified in them that come nigh unto me, and before all the people I will be glorified. And Aaron held his peace. In other words, he knew this was a severe judgment, but it was warranted. Why? Is it that they had performed an act that God said, thou shalt not do this? No. God had nowhere told them, you can't worship me in this way. What was wrong with their action? It was strange. How was it strange? In that it was weird? No. It was strange in that God had not commanded them to worship him in this way. So they were worshiping in a way that had not been commanded. And for that, they were severely punished. Okay, a couple of instances of worship under the monarchy. That's the next major heading. So we've got creation, man's purpose, Sabbath rest, Cain and Abel, Ten Commandments, Law of Moses, worship in the wilderness, and now worship under the monarchy. 1 Samuel 13, 13 through 14. 1 Samuel 13, 13 through 14. Again, we're gathering biblical data. We're beginning to discern some universal principles, some common themes, all in an attempt by the end of the day to arrive at a biblical understanding and definition of worship. 1 Samuel 13, 13 through 14. Okay, you know the context of this. The enemy was coming. Samuel was late. He was supposed to come and offer a sacrifice, but he was late. And so what does Saul do? He says, well, we've got to offer this sacrifice. He really had a good motive, right? He wanted to offer a sacrifice to the Lord. That's a good motive. But nonetheless, he was not sanctioned to do so. And then in verse 13, and Samuel said to Saul, "Thou hast done foolishly. Thou hast not kept the commandment of the Lord thy God, which he commanded thee. For now would the Lord have established thy kingdom upon Israel forever. But now," boy, this is harsh judgment. You thought fire from heaven was harsh. This is even harsher. "But now thy kingdom shall not continue. The Lord has sought him a man after his own heart. And the Lord hath commanded him to be captain over his people, because thou hast not kept that which the Lord commanded thee." So Saul's motive was good. He wanted to offer sacrifice to the Lord. But he didn't obey the commandment of the Lord, and for that he was severely punished. Okay, turn a couple more pages to 1 Samuel 15. One more significant influence, instance under Saul's reign. 1 Samuel 15, look at verse 3. "The commandment of the Lord is this, Now go and smite Amalek, and utterly destroy all they have, and spare them not, but slay both man and woman, infant and suckling, ox and sheep, camel and ass." Verse 9, what did Saul do? "But Saul and the people spared Agag, and the best of the sheep, and the oxen, and of the fatling, and of the lambs, and all that was good, and would not utterly destroy them, but everything that was vile and refuse, and they destroyed utterly." So God commanded him to destroy everything. He didn't do it. And why did he not? Verse 21. "But the people took of the spoil, sheep and oxen, the chief of the things which should have been utterly destroyed." Why? "To sacrifice unto the Lord thy God in Gilgal." Hey, this is a good motive. But what is Samuel's response? Verse 22. "And Samuel said, Hath the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to hearken than the fat of lambs. So here he is saying, you know, no motivation, no matter how good it is enough if you don't obey the Lord. And even doing things that God prescribes aren't right, aren't enough, God is not satisfied with them if we're not obeying him. Okay, we're beginning to see some common themes. Okay, next, what about the tabernacle temple? Tabernacle and temple worship. First, we've also looked at this a little bit from Hebrews 8:5. The tabernacle and the temple was built according to God's specific instructions. Okay? Exodus 25 is like the big, here's how I want it built section. "And let them make me a sanctuary that I may dwell upon them, according to all that they show thee after the pattern of the tabernacle and the pattern of the instruments thereof, even so shall ye make it." And then I'll remind you of what we already looked at in Hebrews 8:5. That pattern was given that somehow reflected something about heavenly worship. So it wasn't just arbitrary. It wasn't just that God said, all right, build it this high and this wide and put this there and that there and whatever. Hebrews 5 says it was an example and a shadow of heavenly things. So what that means, you know, we'll explore. But it wasn't arbitrary, and we can learn something from how it was done, from what was done. We're not constrained to do it that way because we're not Israel. But there are universal principles in the tabernacle worship and even how it was constructed. Okay, number two, transfer of the ark to Jerusalem. Do you remember this? The ark had to be transferred to Jerusalem. What was God's requirement about how the ark should be transferred? You remember? On the shoulders of the priests, using poles. How did they transfer it? on an ox cart. Okay? Is there anything wrong with an ox cart? No. But God had specifically told them, I want it done this way, and they didn't do it that way. And you remember what happened? This is 2 Samuel 6, 1 through 10. And it's also 2 Chronicles 13. What happened? You remember. Uzzah. Okay, so it's bumpy terrain, mountains, hills, and it's on a cart, and must not have been secured well enough, and it starts to slip. What does Uzzah do? Puts out his hand to stop it, and what happens? God kills him. Was that harsh? Well, yeah. And even David recognizes that, right? David gets a little mad. What in the world? Why in the world did you do this? But what did God say? I told you to do things in a certain way. You didn't do them. Here's the punishment. Did Uzzah have a wrong motive? His motive was good. He wanted to keep the ark from falling. But he didn't follow the Lord's command. And therefore he was punished. And so after leaving the ark, you know, in a little town for a while, David learns his lesson in 1 Chronicles 15. He does it the right way. Okay, number three, organization of the tabernacle worship in Jerusalem. 2 Chronicles 29. 2 Chronicles 29. How did they organize the tabernacle worship? Did they decide themselves, hey, this would be a good way to do it? No. 2 Chronicles 29:25, everything was ordered according to the commandment of David and of God, the king's seer, and Nathan the prophet, for so was the commandment of the Lord by the prophets. In other words, God gave very explicit instructions concerning how he wanted to be worshipped. And then finally, the building of the temple. 1 Chronicles 28:11-13. And verse 19 says, David gave to Solomon his son the pattern of the porch and of the houses thereof, and of the patterns of all that he had by the Spirit. This was direct revelation. Also for the courses of the priests and the Levites. All this, said David, the Lord made me understand in writing by his hand upon me, even all the works of this pattern. So again, God gives explicit instructions. Okay? A few more things. We're almost finished here. And we'll take a break. What was the apostasy of the northern kingdom? Okay, do you remember the split of kingdom? Rehoboam divided the kingdom, the north, the south, two separate kingdoms. Okay? 1 Kings 11:37-38. 1 Kings 11:37-38. In this passage, God promises Jeroboam, who is the king of the northern kingdom, that his reign would be firmly established if he followed God's commandments. Here's what he says. God says, and I will take thee, and thou shalt reign according to all thy soul desireth, and thou shalt be king over Israel. And it shall be, if thou wilt hearken unto all that I command thee, and will walk in my ways, and do that which is right in my sight, to keep my statutes and my commandments, as David my servant did, that I will be with thee, and build thee a sure house, as I built for David, and will give Israel unto thee. This is a big promise. Jeroboam, if you obey my commandments, I will honor you, and you will be king over Israel, and I will establish your kingdom forever. But what does Jeroboam do? Instead of obeying the commandments of the Lord, he takes the pragmatic approach. You remember the situation? You know, we've got the northern kingdom, the southern kingdom. Where's Jerusalem? Where is the place that God has prescribed in his law that his people worship him? So here's Jeroboam up here in the northern kingdom. God says, if you obey my commandments, I am going to make you king of Israel and establish your kingdom forever. Well, in order to obey God's commandments, what does he have to require his people to do? Go down in Jerusalem to worship. Well, he doesn't want that. He doesn't want his people to go down to, you know, the other place. So what does he do? He devises his own local program of worship. It's not that he sets up worship for false gods. It's not that he commands his people to worship a god other than Yahweh. He still encourages Yahweh worship, but he establishes, in 1 Kings chapter 12, he establishes a new center of worship, a new means of worship, a new priesthood. It's not that he encourages people to worship other deities, but to worship Yahweh with other means. And because of that, in 1 Kings 13, he was cursed.